If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Levi's, Plow & Hearth, Adidas, Sephora, and Neiman Marcus. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. And it's easy to use. And you get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Rakuten.com.
Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale is almost here. Starting July 24th, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping site-wide. Shop the sale at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Get ready. Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is almost here. It's Black Friday in July, and it's coming your way. For 5 days only, score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair, plus amazing doorbuster deals and free shipping on everything. Yes, everything, right to your door. So mark your calendars. Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale starts July 24th. Shop everything home at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
You've ever watched a trial and thought, wait, what just happened? And why is the judge letting that fly? Well, then welcome to the Karen Reed circus. It's a case, but it's more of a circus, where legal strategy and courtroom chess are happening in full public view. Just days before opening statements in her second trial, the judge handed down rulings that could shift the entire narrative. The defense can now officially point the finger at others, but not everyone. The prosecution is trying to block some of the defense's biggest talking points from trial one. And the lead investigator... well, yeah, he's been fired, but he's still going to testify. It's not just a trial. It's starting to look like the full-blown credibility war. Eric Fatt is joining us. Eric, here's the table setter in a case where the same evidence is being regarded with totally different framing. How much does legal strategy actually change the verdict odds here? Can relitigating the case with tighter rules and sharper tactics lead to a totally different outcome when the facts are, you know, essentially still the same?
It can, Tony. You know, we're dealing with the same core set of facts. That's not going to change. But we have a new prosecutor. We have potentially new experts. We have limitations on defenses. And we have a bunch of public statements the defendant has made since the last mistrial. And you better believe that those things could turn the tables in this case and really make it look a lot different than trial one.
Third-party culprits, it's still in there. I think everybody expected it to be in some way, shape, or form. The 17-year-old is out, thankfully. But they still can name Brian Elbert and Brian Higgins as possible suspects. Are you surprised by this being... I was kind of surprised it was allowed in round one. And now here we are, round two. Just because... there isn't any evidence that points to these people being involved other than somebody saying it out loud. There's nothing in the house. There's nothing that is looked at here as a solid piece of evidence, unless you're looking at it from a conspiracy theory type angle, which you certainly can. But again, it's literally based on some guy, according to the defense of Karen Reed, some shady, weird-looking man coming out of the night, sitting down and saying, "You better look at the people in the house." And then he apparently flies off into the night and nobody knows who this guy is. That's a little weird to just go and say that that's what this is based on. And that's what they said in that documentary, Body in the Snow. Is there more to this? Am I missing something where the judge said, "Yeah, I mean, you can make up this story and then you can argue it like it's fact." That seems a little odd.
You know, I hear you, of course. The defense is usually given significant leeway when it comes to presenting a defense, even if it's a defense that's questionable, that has somewhat dubious support. Usually the judge is going to say, hey, we're not going to eliminate this entirely because we got to give the defense a fighting chance. And if we eliminated a defense entirely, that could be grounds for appeal. This one came about in a pretty curious way, and there are questions as to what is supporting this kind of defense besides just sort of drumming it up in argument and presenting it in a stylized way to a jury.
I mean, you have shady behavior, you know, from some of the officers, certainly, but again, none of it pointed to framing her. It pointed to not liking her, to thinking that she's really not a great woman, you know, and this is the girlfriend of one of their buddies. Yeah, I mean, people have opinions and people can be really crass about how they express things. And in no way am I saying it's good in any way, shape, or form what Proctor did. I think he's a creep and I'm glad that he's not in law enforcement anymore. But again, at the end of the day, none of it pointed to let's frame Karen Reed. It was just, you know, I hope she goes down for this because the evidence really points that this was a hit and run in many ways. Even though I think that can be argued as well, that it's very hard to, I think, definitively show that she actually hit him. So that is, I think, is up in the air. But the fact that, I mean, it is made up. I mean, the whole theory is made up. I mean, and it goes into detail. It's not just they wanted her, you know, to that someone else killed John O'Keefe to frame and then to frame her. I mean, none of it makes a lot of sense. There's not a lot of motive here where we see why any of these guys would want to kill her or kill him. Again, it's literally making things up. I've seen other cases too. I'm sure you have where, you know, there is a bar where there's some level of credibility to a story if you're going to introduce it. In your opinion, did they meet that bar?
You know, the bar in most jurisdictions for presenting alternative suspect defense is something along the lines of you have to show a direct, non-speculative connection between the alternative suspect and the crime that was committed. Here, you know, if I was the judge, I just haven't seen such an evidentiary showing. It's kind of just some, you know, ominous sort of murmurs about like, oh, that house, like something happened there. I don't know. And then on top of that, you have defense bringing this theory of that John O'Keefe was like attacked by a dog. Mm-hmm. How does that square with like a bunch of police officers killing him and framing Karen Reed? Where does the dog come in? There's just so many kind of parts that don't exactly form a coherent presentation to the jury.
No, it doesn't. I want to talk about the dog in a minute, but I want to try to talk about this point too. They're able to introduce third party, but they can't do it in the opening. They have to lead up to it. Why? I mean, explain what is the reasoning that a judge would put that parameter in a case like this?
Tony, I'm kind of reading between the lines here, but the rules to opening statements include that you can't talk about something unless you have a good faith basis that it's going to come into evidence during the trial. And sometimes I think the judge is probably signaling here, like, hey, don't say this in opening because I want to see what the evidence shows. I want to see if you really can connect the dots, present some direct non-speculative connection between an alternative suspect and the crime, at which point then I'll let you say it. But before that, I don't want the jury hearing about something that might not be admitted. So I think the judge has some ongoing reservations about what exactly she's going to let defense talk about with respect to this alternative suspect theory.
I'm wondering as well. The dog, Chloe, it's still alive. They have the casting of the mouth, and that's going to be argued again here. But again, like you were saying, it's a very incoherent piece of the story. Okay, you got beat up in the house, and then what? They said, okay, Chloe, your turn. Have at him. I mean, like, or did like they go in the house and then like the dog attacked John and then John hit back and everybody's like, you don't hit my dog. And then they don't have a story for where the dog ever comes into this. It's just, he was beat up and then the dog bit him. And it's arguable if those are even dog marks. There's no dog DNA that was found on his body. And you would think if the dog is biting you, you'd get something. I know you can go to the outside and in the snow area where I think if it is a dog, that's a bit more likely, or a coyote or something in nature as you're lying there dying. Yeah, I can see a creature coming over and thinking, oh, hey, the buffet's open, you know, but then getting scared away when people walk by. Again, why the dog? Where is, do you think this is going to go, and what does it prove? Even if they can say that Chloe attacked him, I guess it proves that he got to the house, maybe. And it could also say they let the dog out to go to the bathroom and he was lying on the front yard.
Yeah, absolutely. The dog piece does not fit neatly within the other sort of conspiracy narrative that the defense is proposing. And I'm wondering if the strategy behind it is a common defense strategy that's like, you know, you throw everything at the wall and you kind of see what sticks. You try to develop a little doubt here, a little doubt here, a little doubt here. And the cumulative effect of these doubts when taken together can sometimes rise to the threshold of reasonable doubt. And I'm just wondering if that is sort of the horse they're riding on this, and just hoping that maybe they confuse the jury so much the jury doesn't know what happened and they're left with these remaining doubts.
Are you surprised they're going down the same road again with the defense of Karen Reed? I mean, it really is the same sort of thing. Let's do third party. Let's do the dog. Let's, you know, basically repeat ourselves. It didn't work very well last time. I mean, at least, I mean, it got it to be a mistrial. Are they still shooting for that, you think? And you know, maybe we get a mistrial and maybe the state decides, you know what, let's stop wasting our time and money on this. Obviously, you know, getting her to be, you know, found not guilty would be great. But I wonder if they kind of read the tea leaves here, too, that best case scenario, we're going to get maybe another mistrial out of this.
It would be strange for the defense to drastically change courses this far along at the retrial stage, you know, and think about the public outcry. Now, the jurors probably shouldn't and wouldn't hear, you know, what happened in the first trial and what defense argued there. But the public would say, hey, what about all this huge conspiracy? You said it was these police officers who you know, in some people's eyes have had an honorable career and served their public. And the decedent was a police officer. You're blaming them indirectly. And now you're not riding that horse. Were you just lying to us in the beginning in the first trial? I just think the public outcry would be really damning there. But the jury probably wouldn't hear about exactly what was argued in the first trial. And the jury may be spared from such an impression.
Yeah, I mean, the problem, though, is what does the jury know and what do they not know? Because they obviously had a very difficult time seating jurors. And I know, you know, this is supposed to be starting here around now. And when we're recording this, it's towards the end of the week prior to its start. I still wouldn't be surprised. I know they have a jury seated, but would you put money that some are going to drop before this thing actually kicks off still, and they're going to be left with needing more jurors in the last minute? Or at this point, now that the jury is seated, if some of the alternates drop and, you know, they don't have 18 anymore, they end up with like 16 by the time trial starts, do they go back and get more jurors, or is this locked in at this point? And if they drop, they drop.
You know, there is always that concern with a high-profile case, and especially a high-profile retrial, where a lot of people already know what happened at the first trial. There are similar concerns in Harvey Weinstein's retrial that's coming up. And so the judge is really has the responsibility of ensuring that there are enough jurors who are fair and impartial. And that's why they're padding the jury box. They want additional alternative jurors for just the contingencies you've mentioned. Folks might drop off. They might say, oh, wait, yeah, I actually know a ton about the case and I can't be fair. And any sorts of things can happen at that phase. And so it's smart for the judge to really have a ton of alternates to try to get this thing to some kind of finality at the end.
If they're down some come Monday, can they say we got to seat more jurors, or is the box sealed now and we start running out? We start running out. I wonder about that, because I could totally see over the weekend as people are with their families and, you know, like, are you really sure you want to be part of this? And, you know, some people getting talked out, because I'm going to guess over Easter dinner, somebody's going to be enjoying their ham loaf and Aunt Bernice is going to be like, I've been watching this on court TV and I think you have a high chance of being assassinated in your home if you stay on this jury. That may make someone think otherwise if they, I know they can't discuss any of it, but you can't stop Aunt Bernice from, you know, spouting off after eight glasses of Franzia and ham loaf.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, really the deadline for adding jurors would be the point at which the opening statements begin.
Okay.
And so long as that hasn't happened yet, the judge could make a pivot. They could take additional measures to bring more jurors on because, yeah, you never know what could happen with these folks. And we've seen other cases where the jurors have said, oh, I don't know a whole lot about the case. And then there are second thoughts and perhaps they're talking to people and it really mucks up the whole thing.
If I was playing Karen Reed roulette, I'd put money on that one. I know it's not super likely, but it's like betting zero after, you know, a lot of reds. Like, it's going to come up some point here. And I'm wondering if this is going to be an issue come Monday. Let's talk about the Proctor problem, which was a problem the first round, but he was still employed as an officer of the law. Not that I think that really made a huge difference in the mind of the jury, but now he's fired. Does it make a difference in the mind of the jury, or does his tactics and his, you know, vocabulary still play and have pretty much the same weight as it did round one?
You know, a lot of people think that Proctor helped really tank the government's case in the first trial. There were some unsavory messages and actions on behalf of Trooper Proctor. And so the government has kind of a dilemma because, you know, do they not call him and then risk the defense calling him and the defense kind of suggesting to the jury, hey, look what the prosecution was hiding? Or do they call Trooper Proctor, the government, and sort of front all of these bad facts for the jury and just say, hey, you know, things happen. Trooper Proctor was not, you know, the most involved law enforcement officer in this. And you know, he's fired now. And that doesn't mean Karen Reed is somehow not guilty. I think that's likely that the track the government is going to take on that.
Yeah. Where just, yeah, get in front of it and like, yeah, he's a bad officer and we got rid of him. But that doesn't mean the whole investigation was bad, although one could argue that, too. The prosecution wants to introduce texts from O'Keefe about ending the relationship, messages that he had sent with some friends, family members. They weren't central in the first trial, but now they might be used. How? I mean, what does it establish here? Does it establish motive that, well, Karen thought, well, if I can't be with him, nobody can. Let's hit it in reverse. Or I don't know. What does it show? I'm all for introducing them and seeing them. But does it really just to me, it kind of just shows that it was an unhealthy relationship and it was coming to an end.
You know, I think the government introducing John O'Keefe's text regarding ending the relationship with Karen Reed would be a substantial misstep. In the first trial, that was one of the problems I thought with the government's case. They overplayed their hand. They were trying to argue that Karen Reed had some motivation to harm John O'Keefe and that she kind of did this on purpose or at least knowingly. And I think that this request to introduce those texts in the second round suggests the government's going to make similar arguments about a motive and that Karen Reed was doing this on purpose. And I think that everyone who has seen this that I've talked to, that is not the impression they got, that this might have been a horrible accident. It's a bit unclear exactly what happened, but it likely wasn't Karen Reed maliciously mowing down John O'Keefe. And for the government to try to ride that horse again, I think would be stupid.
The How's Long to Die in Cold at 2:27 a.m. It's the battle of the experts with this one. That's got to be confusing for a jury where you have one independent expert saying, no, it means this. And then you have the actual people from Cellbrite going, no, you're misinterpreting the coding and how this actually works. Your version does say this, but if you actually understand how it works and here's why it works and how it works, it means this. It's based on the browser window opening, not the other. And it really kind of comes down to what you want to believe. Like, who do you feel more inclined to get behind? But this, to me, I don't know how this is even up for debate. It seems like this would be something that it's either factually black or white. Why can we not get to some sort of factually black or white answer on this topic?
Lawyers, man. It's just, you know,
you effers.
That's part of an attorney's job is to present the best version of the facts for your client that you can. And at least according to some, there's one version of these searches that happen at this time. There's another version where somebody is colorably arguing through an expert that no, it happened at a different time. And it's going to be terribly confusing for the jury. I'm a little surprised the court is allowing it, because what we're talking about is raw data and really just what that data means. And the defense did a good job of sort of, drumming up what they think it means. And I guess the jury's going to hear about that again and be confused again.
Yeah. I mean, I am surprised the court, is the court just as confused as everybody else going, well, we don't do these sort of extractions. We don't truly know. But one expert says this, I mean, maybe they just don't know themselves. I mean, could the court have at some point here in this intermission between trials, knowing that this is going to come up, I don't know, looked into it themselves a little bit more to factually try and get a black or white answer to how this data is produced? Or is it just, well, we just kind of got to make a decision based on what we know?
Yeah, probably not. Courts are usually disinclined to do their own kind of investigation. Mm-hmm. Now, occasionally they can appoint someone to do an investigation for them. But, when they do their own investigation, that potentially makes the judge and court staff witnesses. Mm-hmm. And then they could be called at the trial in the case. And so it would be unlikely for the court to do that. They kind of got to rely on what they're getting.
Yeah, it would probably make it even messier. New thing to this case, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on it, is the all of the interviews, all of the Karen contradictions. And there are a lot of them. I mean, just the night of the incident itself, you have Karen initially saying on camera, well, could I have hit him? I might have hit him. He didn't look mortally wounded. And then back to theoretical talking, which I find very interesting that she flat out said in present tense, he didn't look mortally wounded. That's a statement of seeing something. It's not a theoretical, well, if I had looked at him and he didn't look mortally wounded, I would have done this. It was just, he didn't look mortally wounded. You got that. Then you get, I didn't remember dropping him off. And then I saw him and I pulled away. Then I saw and watched him stick his head in the door. And then I saw him get in another statement. And I left because I was not feeling good. And I left because I was angry. I mean, and she's listening to U2 on her stereo really loud in the car, blasting it. So we have all these variants on things she has publicly said. And the jury, if they can get it in some way or shape or form, can see the yin and the yang of all of this and just how inconsistent these statements are. First question, how are they going to get it in without Karen being on the stand?
Sure. So the government is entitled to present statements, including hearsay statements, out-of-court statements that the defendant made or that are attributable to the defendant under a hearsay exception called admission by a party of opponent. Mm-hmm. And so the government will be able to show, hey, the defendant said this, but then she said this, and then she said this, and those things don't really jive mm-hmm. together to show that the defendant was being inconsistent about how she was describing what happened and her mental state and everything else. And so I think that is a problem, and it is compounded by the additional statements she has made, Karen Reed, since the trial mm-hmm. to the media and to others.
Yeah, they're taking it all. I mean, it's just, I mean, I've clipped them out already, and it's just a laundry list of insanity. It's just things that look really, really bad. Again, none of it shows that she hit him, but it shows a lot of uncertainty. It shows that she clearly wonders if she did, not this, I couldn't have, that's impossible, but I'm sure we'll see the, did I? And I couldn't have, it's impossible, back to back. When can they get this in? I mean, I know that we saw the kind of laundry list of how they're planning to do opening statements, and they're planning on using video. Is opening when they're planning on just, you know, bursting the dam open, going, look, she contradicts herself everywhere. Let's begin at this point. Or do they have to have a witness on the stand to introduce that sort of stuff? That's my question of how are they getting it in? Because clearly if Karen's on the stand, boom. But if she never takes the stand, how do they introduce this?
So they could reference it in opening. That's a little risky because, especially for the prosecution, if you say something in opening and then that for some reason doesn't come into evidence during the trial, you're risking a serious mistrial. And so the more cautious approach would be to sort of vaguely reference inconsistent statements and then put witnesses on the stand to whom Karen Reed made these statements. And those witnesses would be allowed to testify, hey, Karen Reed told me this. Hey, Karen Reed told me that. And if there's video evidence, people with foundation regarding that video, like if it's body cam, you'd have an officer up there. So there are witnesses through whom they can get in these statements from Karen Reed. And it really could be problematic, especially with Karen Reed's like obstinance now that it couldn't possibly have been me. Well, those statements you made, the day of suggest otherwise.
Well, you certainly have that with the did I hit him and all that with the first responders and everything there. But a lot of these statements were made to like Dennis Murphy at Dateline and other, other reporters who were documenting the case. So it was, I mean, you probably find maybe, I don't know, some friends who it may have been stated to, but these were stated in media interviews. So who do you call to say she said this to me? Do you call the reporters? I mean, who takes the stand to say, yes, she said this to me?
Generally, calling reporters to talk about statements of defendants is disfavored. There's sort of this argument that we don't want a chilling effect on reporters, getting important information out to the public and then being hauled into court and scrutinized for it. So what usually happens is the government will just have an investigator review the footage, review the Dateline thing. There's no dispute as to whether she actually gave the interview and whether it's her in the interview. And the investigator could just say, hey, I've compiled all of these videos that are public statements by the defendant, and they're relevant to this case. Jury, you got to hear this.
So we can get it in. It's not going to be a real question of where it's going to be.
No, I don't think so.
All right, good. That's going to be interesting. All right, to wrap up, strongest thing you think that the prosecution is going in with this time and the strongest thing that you think the defense has going for them this round?
With the defense, I think that really what happened has been so muddled. There has been so many suggestions here and there and all different kinds of defense theories. And so to bring that chaos and to bring that confusion and to just say, hey, look, we don't really know what happened here. And if we don't know what happened here, can we really convict this person of a crime? That's defense's best approach. Mm-hmm. Prosecution's best approach is defendant. It's Karen Reed.
Yeah.
It's using her inconsistent statements and then sort of her brash, some would say maybe callous and arrogant demeanor, aloofness afterwards in public media statements to show, hey, look, you can't believe a word this person says, and the evidence instead suggests she did it.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.